From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Two state agencies are recommending that fracking be allowed in Western Maryland, but only if tough restrictions are put on drilling. We asked the chairman of a commission that advised on the report about fracking standards and what we might expect from Governor-elect Larry Hogan. Then, tis the season for the Nutcracker. The famous ballet has a slew of upcoming local productions. Tom Hall talks with the folks behind two of them. Plus, theater critic Jaywin Russick tells us whether It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play, lives up to the movie's classic status. And for the many people who've lost loved ones this year, the holidays can be a difficult time. We talk about dealing with grief and mourning with bereavement counselor Beth Hewitt. First, the news.
I'm Nathan Sterner, and if you were listening to Maryland Morning Live, I'd be bringing you the latest Maryland news right about now. You can catch the live show Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 FM in Ocean City, and online at WYPR.org. For now, you're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Let's get the show underway.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Two state agencies have concluded that drilling for natural gas in Western Maryland can be done without seriously endangering communities or the environment. The Department of Environment and Department of Natural Resources have released recommendations for how such drilling, using new techniques including horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, should be regulated. Those recommendations are now open for comment. With me in the studio to talk about fracking in Maryland is David Banco. He's chairman of the state commission that refereed the conclusions. It's known as the Marcellus Shale Safe Drilling Initiative Advisory Commission. He's also dean of the College of Science and Mathematics at Towson University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What were the issues for which this commission was tasked to make recommendations?
Well, the commission, which started about 3.5 years ago, was set up to advise environment and natural resources on whether Maryland can go forward with hydraulic fracturing safely and without undue risk. Specifically, the departments were asked to produce three reports with our advice. One report on revenue and liability issues. One report on best practices that the industry uses or could use that we see elsewhere. And then a final report, a third report that integrates everything and ultimately allows the state to decide whether to move forward. It's the final report that has just been released a little over a week ago and will be discussed within the next couple of days and finalized.
Why did it take 3.5 years to produce this final report?
It took 3.5 years because the state's oil and gas regulations that came from the 1950s and 1960s were simply inadequate to deal with the new technologies that are being used in fracking. There are many, many issues to be studied. We studied, as I said, best practices. We commissioned an economic study. We commissioned a public health study. And the departments underwent a risk analysis that we advised that they do. So these things took quite a lot of time. We've had 35 commission meetings, mostly in Western Maryland. And it's been a long but very deliberative and very thoughtful process.
The report says, in conclusion, quote, best practices and rigorous monitoring, inspection, and enforcement can reduce the risks to acceptable levels, but cannot completely eliminate all the risks, close quote. How can fracking be done safely in Western Maryland?
Well, if all of these regulations and enforcement and monitoring and application of best practices takes place, the conclusion of the departments is that it can be done safely. And that doesn't mean that risk is completely eliminated. Similar to when we get in the car, our risks aren't completely eliminated. There are still risks there. But the risk analysis, for example, showed that most of the risks that would still be present have to do with the trucking related to the industry, bringing truckloads of pipes and water and chemicals and things of that nature to a drill site and away from a drill site. So risks of accidents, risks of road damage, We actually studied over 60 different risk pathways that were likely, and for each risk pathway, looked at what sort of regulations could be put in place or were already in place to reduce the risk of that particular pathway. So again, that's partly why it took 3.5 years. It's a complicated issue.
There is less natural gas in Maryland than in Pennsylvania or West Virginia. Is the economic benefit great enough to justify the risk?
That's true. Maryland only has about 1.7% of the total Marcellus shale in the Appalachian Basin. So most of it is in Pennsylvania, New York, West Virginia, and Ohio. Nevertheless, that 1.7% is a significant, represents a significant resource and a lot of money, even at today's prices.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Dean David Vanko, chair of a state commission on fracking that released recommendations last month. We're talking about the future of fracking in Maryland. Governor O'Malley said these would be the toughest regulations any state has adopted, and some industry critics say they'd be so tough that no companies would be able to meet them and actually start drilling. What's your expectation?
Well, he's absolutely right. What's been suggested is what he wanted, which is what we call a gold standard of monitoring and regulation. We would require multiple years of monitoring of the environment before drilling. Maryland would be the first state to require what's called a comprehensive gas development plan from a company.
For so every well?
Well, usually you get a permit for each well. What Maryland will require is that instead the companies come forward with a holistic plan that shows where they want all their wells, where they want all their access roads, where they want all their pipelines, so that the state can look at that as one proposal and might say, well, now, wait a minute, you can do a better job of protecting the environment if you move these well pads closer together, farther apart, whatever. The point is that comprehensive gas development plan is sort of a landscape look at the potential impact of the activity, and Maryland can say, is this company going to do a good job? If so, then they could give permits.
Governor-elect Larry Hogan said during the campaign that fracking could be a gold mine. Are you expecting your recommendations to be rolled back?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, the Maryland regulations as they stand are completely inadequate, and no one can come in and say, we've been talking about this long enough, our regulations are good enough, let's move forward. But our recommendations that the state is promoting set a very high bar, and a higher bar than anyone else. I am concerned that that bar could be eroded, that it could be lowered, and certain ideas could be cherry-picked and knocked off. I'm not a politician, but the issue now is going to be largely one of politics. There's one interesting new aspect with the gubernatorial change, and that is that the commission has always operated under the assumption that state lands will not be developed. Secretary John Griffith, Secretary Joe Gill have both said state land is off limits. That's quite in contrast to Pennsylvania, where several years ago the governor required the state to allow leasing on state lands in order to generate revenue. It turns out that a policy decision, a stroke of the pen, could open up state lands in Maryland to drilling and gas development.
So in the area underlain by the Marcellus Shale, what state lands might we be talking about?
There's a lot of acreage in Garrett County and Allegheny County that is owned by the state and currently off limits to development. Savage River State Forest and many other properties that the state parks and state forests out in western Maryland.
I'm grateful to you for talking to us.
It's been my pleasure.
Dean David Vanko. He chairs the Marcellus Shale Safe Drilling Initiative Advisory Commission. At 3 this afternoon, the commission will present its recommendations and take public comments at meetings in Baltimore and Garrett County. We have links to more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
So it tis the season to be jolly, and if you're a ballet dancer, tis the season to be busy. The Nutcracker Ballet, with the immortal music of Tchaikovsky and a grand tradition of annual performances all over the globe, is in high season here in Maryland. This month, nearly 20 ballet companies from all over the state will offer partial and complete performances of this Christmas classic, which means that hundreds of angels and mice and toy soldiers, along with dozens of sugar plum fairies and assorted handsome princes, are getting ready to tell us the tale of Clara Stahlbaum's magical night on that Christmas Eve long ago. This morning, a conversation with two people who are involved in a couple of those very many performances. By day, Kurt Decker is the executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. But if you've been to any of the Baltimore School for the Arts productions of The Nutcracker over the last 20 years, you know him as Uncle Drosselmeyer, Clara's toy-making godfather, who gives Clara her cherished gift. Kathy Ferguson is the founder and director of the Howard County Ballet. They'll perform their Nutcracker with a live orchestra beginning next weekend in Ellicott City. And Kurt Decker and Kathy Ferguson join me this morning here in Studio A. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Tom.
It's good to see you. So, Kurt, what is the appeal of the Nutcracker for you? As a person who's been through so many performances and as a person who knows dance and knows ballet, what does this piece mean to you?
Well, it still gives me an opportunity to be on stage many years later after I stopped dancing semi-professionally. But it's also an opportunity to work with some incredible kids who are just getting involved in ballet. The School for the Arts, as you know, has over 120 kids in this production, from twigs who are coming in from inner city schools after school.
And they're the real little ones.
Real little ones. We go from, I think, age 6 to age 70. I won't tell you who the person who is 70 on the stage, but it's a wonderful assortment of kids, including the students themselves, many who will finish their senior year and go on to companies.
And Kathy Ferguson, this is a piece that just resonates with audiences around the globe and has ever since it, you know, was first launched in public in the 19th century. What do you think it is about this particular piece? Why is this the one that has been elevated to such a lofty stature at this time of year?
Number one, it's the music. Number two, I think it's the difference in varying abilities that are needed to do the ballet. So it covers the entire scope. And interestingly enough, the ballet was not really accepted when it was done because they didn't like the difference between the mice and the soldiers, of the mice being not such an strict part as the soldiers. Mm-hmm. And they thought everything should be very even.
Because that's the thing. I mean, there are people who have very little dance experience who can be put into a very good production of the Nutcracker.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Then, of course, there are prima ballerinas and, you know, folks that really need to be, you know, professionally trained. But there is a great scope of abilities needed for a production of this piece.
Oh, one thing that is interesting is that in England, Peter Pan is their Christmas ballet,
mm-hmm.
quote. But in the United States, it really is just the Nutcracker.
Yeah, and it's a great piece, that's for sure. So, Kurt Decker, you began dancing in the cast of this Nutcracker back when it was a production that the Maryland Ballet used to do.
That's correct. I was fortunate to have missed a career when I was younger, but after leaving law school and coming to Baltimore, I started taking classes at the Peabody. And as I said, I think I had two assets as a dancer. I was male and breathing.
At the same time.
And so that made me quite, a catch for lots of companies in town. So I got to do a lot of things. Fairly late for a dancer, and began dancing in the Nutcracker with the Maryland Ballet. Actually, took some vacation and went on tour to Chattanooga and Roanoke. And then a lot of the closing of the ballet coincided with the creation of the School for the Arts, and so a lot of the professional dancers went over to the school as teachers, people like Sylvester Campbell, who was a wonderful, wonderful dancer and a great teacher, and they began to do full-length Nutcrackers several years into the school's existence, and they called and said, we need someone who can get across the stage and not fall down.
So. Yeah, and you were terrific at that.
Thank you.
I've never seen you fall once. It's very impressive.
Yet.
Very, not yet. That's right. There's a first time for everything.
Indeed.
And Kathy Ferguson, the Howard County Ballet, one of the main tenets of your founding this company 20-something years ago was that you wanted to make sure that the productions had live music. So tell us about the sort of concept that you had when you founded the company and how you've pulled that off since.
Well, actually, the orchestra found me. From the beginning, the basics were that the production was rehearsed outside of the classroom, and they didn't learn their dances inside the classroom. And then I was approached by one of the parents of the Columbia Orchestra, and they thought of introducing me to my conductor, David Jazik, and between all three of us, Elaine Newall, David Zajic, and I, we conceived and put together the Howard County Ballet Orchestra. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful addition to just to feel the live music.
Sure. Yeah, and Kurt Decker, the Baltimore School for the Arts has been collaborating over these last couple of years with the Baltimore Symphony. So now your productions also have live music, and you did it for many years with recorded music when you were doing it at the Baltimore School for the Arts. What's the difference for you as a performer on stage having a live orchestra in the pit as opposed to canned music?
Well, it's night and day, and as Kathy was saying, to be able to dance to live music is really a special treat. So many ballet companies in this country can't afford to do that. So this is a marvelous collaboration, not only with the Baltimore Symphony, but also with MICA, who's doing the sets. Students at MICA are doing the sets, and the lyric itself. It requires you to really pay attention, because depending on how much coffee the conductor's had in between performances, the tempos can be quite different than you were used to in the tapes. And so it just has that spark of spontaneity that is just marvelous, and that so many, as I said, so many companies can't experience because of budgetary concerns.
Sure, of course. And as a conductor who's conducted ballet before, there's also opportunities to, sort of play on the energy of the room in a live performance. Whereas, as if the music is canned, it sounds exactly the same every night. You don't adjust to the energy of the audience.
Now, you do hope the conductor will look up occasionally to see what the dancers are doing. a good ballet conductor really understands what's going on stage, knows when to speed up or slow down, depending on whether the dancers are tired or need to be pepped up. And so it takes, I think, a special talent to be a ballet conductor.
Yeah. And Kathy Ferguson, so you do find a part for everybody. People don't even really audition for your production, or they audition, but you see what they can do, and then you find a part that fits their abilities.
Well, actually, all the parts are graded choreographically by the abilities of the dancers.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody auditions, but there is also a place to put them.
Yeah, so how many folks do you have from the Howard County community that are involved in the productions every year?
Well, between the orchestra, which is 48 to 61 pieces, and the conductor, and then all the backstage, there's 75 performers, and everyone has three parts. Everybody has three parts according to the three sections of the ballet. So there's 150 costumes.
That's terrific. That's a lot of folks. Well, thank you both for coming in, and good luck and happy holidays as you put these performances together. Appreciate
it. Thank
you, John. Kurt Decker plays the role of Uncle Drosselmeyer in the Baltimore School for the Arts and Baltimore Symphony Orchestra's production of The Nutcracker at the Modell Performing Arts Center at the Lyric Theater in Baltimore. Their performance is December 19th through 21st. Kathy Ferguson is the founder and director of the Howard County Ballet. Ballet. You can catch their Nutcracker, which also has live music by the Howard County Ballet Orchestra, next Sunday, as well as the following weekend at Centennial High School in Ellicott City. The Baltimore Ballet will present their version of the Nutcracker this weekend at Goucher College. The Moscow Ballet will be in town with their touring production of this holiday classic at the Hippodrome Theater the weekend after next. You'll also find Nutcrackers in Annapolis, Aberdeen, Laurel, Bethesda, Germantown, and several other places around the state. If you come to our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, we'll give you a link to a complete list. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. So if the Nutcracker is the quintessential Christmas ballet, It's a Wonderful Life is the quintessential holiday movie. In Center Stage's current production, the iconic story is told in the form of a radio play. Maryland Morning Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has seen it, and she brings us this review.
It's a Wonderful Life is, well, a wonderful movie. It's heartwarming but gritty, and it's brimming with can-do American spirit, particularly when it comes to the plight of the individual against the forces of big business. A political statement that, unfortunately, remains timely. A year after Frank Capra's classic movie debuted, It's a Wonderful Life was adapted for radio, a common practice at the time. Using that model, playwright Joe Landry created It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play. This popular regional theater holiday offering is now at Center Stage. The production is entertaining, but may give pause to enthusiasts of radio and Frank Capra. In Landry's version, as in I Love Lucy live on stage, which played the Hippodrome in October, theatergoers become the studio audience at a live broadcast. As fans of It's a Wonderful Life will remember, protagonist George Bailey owns a small building and loan in fictitious Bedford Falls, a business he struggles to keep out of the clutches of the town's richest man, mean old Mr. Potter.
Just one thing more, though. This town needs this measly one-horse institution. If only to have some place where people can come without crawling to Potter!
That's Joseph McGranahan as George, standing up to Potter. George's story is told in flashback to his guardian angel Clarence, who comes into George's life at its lowest ebb. Clarence turns George's life around by showing him what Bedford Falls would have been like if he'd never been born. Oh yes, and this takes place on Christmas Eve. Okay, it's hokey, but it's got some thematic heft. Frank Capra, whom I interviewed for The Sun years ago, described himself as a social force in films. He exemplified the little man taking on the system. But serious themes and character development get short shrift in Landry's adaptation and its interpretation by director Nelson T.U. Cibio III at Center Stage. Between the radio conceit and the fact that only five actors play basically the entire town, there's not much room for depth. For instance, Ken Krugman is amusing carrying on both sides of a conversation between snarling Mr. Potter and George's stuttering sweet Uncle Billy. But Krugman's Potter is a caricature, the villain out of an old-time melodrama. As George, Joseph McGranahan doesn't register enough desperation or exuberance or undergo much of a change. Only Kiara Motley, as George's wife Mary, successfully imbues her character with sincerity and heart. The production gives up most efforts to simulate a radio broadcast fairly early on. The actors abandon their microphones and scripts. There's a cute moment when George and Mary fall in love and toss their pages in the air. But the audience is left untethered. Where are we, a radio show or a stage play? This gets even blurrier in a scene where adult actors crawl on the floor as George and Mary's children, especially male actors speaking in low voices. It's a choice that doesn't work for radio or the stage. To add to the confusion, an onstage sound effects man continues in true radio style after the actors have shed their scripts. Admittedly, he's great fun. Versatile musician Anthony Stultz toots a cab horn when a sexy woman waltzes by, swishes water in a barrel when a character falls through the ice, and bangs trash can lids when a drunken reveler stumbles home. Stultz is in his prime when we learn what George did during World War II.
George? What about George?
George? 4F on account of his ear. George fought the Battle of Bedford Falls. Air raid warden, paper dry, scrap dry, rubber dry.
Center Stage calls this radio show WBAL Playhouse of the Air, and includes commercials for two favorite Baltimore products. I won't spoil the surprise by revealing which ones. This isn't the first stage adaptation of It's a Wonderful Life. Washington's Arena Stage produced a musical version in 1991, complete with roller skating angels. That version proved what this one doesn't, that an adaptation needs to improve on or at least bring out something new in its source. Instead, It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play, takes a moving movie about resilience and the power of the individual and turns it into a holiday trifle, pleasant but insubstantial.
Life is at Baltimore's Center Stage for two more weeks. It closes on the Sunday before Christmas. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, will be back again next Monday morning with a review of another holiday classic, A Christmas Carol, which is being presented by the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass on this, the first day of our year-end membership campaign. Why don't you give us a call, 410-235-1395.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. It's a truism that the holidays can be hard for people who have recently lost a loved one. But knowing that doesn't tell us how to help, whether we ourselves are grieving or someone we care about. So I was struck with the title of one of the books by bereavement counselor Beth Hewitt, More Good Words, Practical Activities for Mourning. The first word, more, makes sense because Hewitt titled an earlier book, Good Words, Memorializing Through a Eulogy. But it's the second part of the title that grabbed my attention, Practical Activities for Mourning. So I asked Beth Hewitt, who is an adjunct professor at University of Maryland University College, as well as a facilitator of grief workshops and support groups, to speak with us about it, and she's with me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Good morning.
You make a distinction between grief and mourning. What's the difference?
Grief is a passive emotion. It's something that we feel when we have lost someone or something that's very dear to us. Mourning is what we do about it. It's putting into action the feelings that we have with grief. And mourning is a healing process. Grief can sit with us for a long time and even make us sick if we don't do anything about it. Mourning is what we do with it.
So mourning doesn't flow out of grief unless you consciously make it?
I think it's not an automatic thing. And when a society encourages mourning from the very beginnings of a funeral, for example, to even wailing or crying or having a grief group or talking with other people or wearing clothes that indicate that I've lost somebody, in those cases where society encourages mourning, then we do so more naturally. We live in a mourning-avoidant society, so we often need to learn some ways to mourn.
But I think some people will hear about some of the practical activities that you say people might find helpful, like journaling, writing about the person you've lost, or making a T-shirt quilt to remember the person you've lost, and say that's prolonging your grief. It's prolonging the mourning because you're reminding yourself in a physical way. And I presume you don't think that. So tell us why not.
I don't think that. That's a really good question. I don't think that because I know that the loss is there anyway. And to ignore it is to stuff it down. To do something with it is to acknowledge this person's presence in my life. And so, in fact, for me and for many people, it is the doing of something that is the helpful part.
One of the things you write, you urge, quote, walk toward the pain. Explain that.
The Sufi poet Rumi said that the way through the pain is through the pain. The way to get through pain is to experience it, to embrace the fact that we have pain about someone that we love having died. We need to acknowledge that it hurts as opposed to running away from it or medicate it or in some way try to dampen it. And when I work with people, sometimes I say, if I told you to take off your shoes and walk on this hotbed of coals, you would tell me I was crazy. Mm-hmm. But embracing the pain of grief means walking on that hotbed of coals and saying to myself how much that hurts and acknowledging that that pain is real and that it's okay. It won't always be this bad. But if we run away from it, it will never get better.
Part of mourning, you write, is to figure out your own new identity now that this person you loved is no longer in the physical world. Why is your identity up for grabs in a time of mourning?
It's funny, but the people that we love are like a mirror through which we see ourselves. And when that mirror isn't there anymore, we need to figure out who we look like, what we are. And the loss of someone that we love, for example, I'll give you a personal example. When my older brother died 14 years ago, I had to take on new identities in the family. I was no longer the second child. I was the oldest child. And as the oldest child, I needed to take on some of the duties that he had been prepared to do, not me. That's one way that an identity changes.
And how this whole process of mourning, how do you do that in the holiday season when the world around you is celebrating?
That's a really good question. Very purposefully, you make decisions for yourself about how you want to acknowledge the holiday. Sometimes people who traditionally have loved Christmas, for example, decide not to put up a Christmas tree. And that has to be an okay decision for them to make. Sometimes they need to buy a different tree or put a special tree up with ornaments particularly relative to the person who died. Sometimes mourning in that case involves making sure that certain songs are sung or that gifts are made that are relevant to the loss, that the family acknowledges that someone has died, that this person's name is used often, frequently, or even that a candle is lit for the special holiday meal, the candle representing the light of the person who has gone and is no longer there with us, but that the light is still in our hearts.
Thank you for all these ideas. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Beth Hewitt is certified in compassionate bereavement care. We have information about her Good Words and More Good Words books at our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us this morning. Thanks to everyone who's supporting WYPR during our pledge drive.